This podcast is brought to you by ClearBridge Investments. Meet an evolving economy confidently with ClearBridge Active Equities, the foundation of a resilient portfolio. ClearBridge, a Franklin Templeton company. Go to clearbridge.com to learn more.
Please stay tuned for important disclosure information at the conclusion of this episode. Welcome to the Investing Insights podcast from Morningstar. In this week's podcast, Tim Steffen from PIMCO shares year-end tax planning ideas. Christine Benz emphasizes the importance of emergency funds. Russ Kinnell talks about the 2020 market rotation. David Swartz picks two bargains in the retail industry. And Michael Jansey uncovers how investors are embracing sustainable investing. Let's get started. Christine Benz from Morningstar Inc. brainstorms year-end tax planning ideas with Tim Steffen of PIMCO.
Hi, I'm Christine Benz from Morningstar. We're coming into the home stretch of 2020, and that means that you still have a little bit of time to improve your tax position for the year. Joining me to share some ideas on this front is Tim Steffen. He's Advisor Education Senior Consultant for PIMCO. Tim, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Christine. Great to see you again.
Good to see you too. So let's talk about the key steps that people should take when thinking about their tax position. Let's start with the current year. What sort of information should people be gathering when thinking about their tax position for this calendar year?
Sure. Yeah. You want to understand where you fall relative to certain breakpoints and thresholds and phase outs and all that this year. So understand, you know, looking at the different tax brackets, where do you fall? Which bracket are you in? How much room do you have before you can move up to a bracket? Or what would it take to lower your income into a lower bracket? Where do you stand relative to realized capital gains and losses for the year? Does it make sense to maybe do some things to offset those? If this is a year where you're going to be itemizing deductions, does it make sense to try and bring some of those into the year to take advantage of that? Or if you're not going to be itemizing, what might you do? Or understanding limits like phase outs for medical expense deductions or the limitations on charitable contributions or all those other types of things out there. So just take a snapshot of where you're at right now and understand where do I stand relative to these things? Because that's going to drive some of the decisions you make later in the year.
Okay. So you also think it's important to take a look forward into 2021, think about any changes that you might see, changes that you've had perhaps in your own life or that you might see in your own tax position. Can you walk us through what people should have on their radars from that standpoint?
Sure. A few of the big ones, like if for example, you're planning to retire in 2021 or you retired midway through 2020, you're going to be seeing this perhaps steady decline in your income from a full year's of work to a part year of work to no work. So you're going to see your taxable income maybe shrink. And does that maybe push, cause you to shift the timing of recognizing certain items of income or deductions? If you're getting married next year, does that mean you're taking two, if you have two people with similar levels of income getting married, they might find themselves in a higher tax bracket. Two people with very different levels of income who get married might find themselves in a lower net bracket overall. So there's a lot of things to take a look at, you know, what is happening next year that doesn't have any impact on what's happening now, but might trigger some of the, or force some of the decisions you make relative to, again, additional income or deductions over these next 2 years.
Speaking of the future, we just had a big election, and I know that many investors are thinking about how that might change their tax position going forward. Can you shed any light on that? Should people even be spending much time thinking about that at this point?
Yeah. So, you know, in addition to what's going on in your own life, you got to look at what's happening outside in the rest of the world. And are there things legislatively happening that might cause you to change some of your approaches, like what we saw several years ago when the TCJA rolled in after at the end of 2017? So if you look at, you know, what might happen in a potential in a Biden administration next year, and we've seen a lot of the proposals that have come out from his camp on tax law changes that they might be interested in making. There's a lot of uncertainty as to whether those are actually going to happen or not. You know, a lot depends on what's going to happen with some of these runoff races happening in Georgia as far as full control of the Senate. And then there's some uncertainty as to the specifics of some of his proposals. There's been a lot of talk about no tax increases for anybody with income below $400,000. We're not really sure exactly what that means. Does that mean gross income, adjusted gross income, taxable income, business income only? What about singles versus married? So there's a lot of uncertainty as to how some of those things might impact people. But there are things out there that people should be aware of that, you know, the other thing to consider is effective date. So just because he maybe takes office next year, do those changes get pushed out to late in the year, maybe don't become effective until 2022? So before you make any big decisions now, anticipating tax law changes, you take a step back and really think, are they really affecting me? When might be the effective date? Are they really going to happen? So a lot of uncertainties in reacting to potential law changes right now.
Okay. So let's talk about some specific things that investors might think about as the year winds down. Let's start with some sort of portfolio considerations with respect to taxes.
So the most common one is looking at your capital gains situation, understanding the different breakpoints on capital gains rates. You know, there's the 0, the 15, the 20% rate. There's the 3.8% net investment tax that kind of filters in there somewhere. Understanding if you have net gains this year, perhaps it makes sense to accelerate some losses into the year, recognize some losses to offset those gains. Remember the netting rules on capital gains, that short-term losses offset short-term gains, long-term losses offset long-term gains. And then if you have a gain or loss in each of those, they can offset each other after they offset their own kind. So, you know, look at your capital gain position and then understand what are the optimal losses that I might want to recognize. Obviously, we wish we didn't have any losses in our portfolio. This has been a weird year, so it's, you know, likely there may be some out there. If you've got them, they're an asset to you. Take advantage of them. Use it to offset your gains if it makes sense.
Right. Tim, you referenced this is a little bit of a weird year in that investors truly might have some really strong gainers in their portfolios, like especially mm-hmm. in the growth side of the style box, yeah. as well as some losers. If they have energy names or value-oriented yeah. holdings, they may actually be able to do some of that netting.
Exactly. And then, you know, with mutual funds making their distributions coming out this year, with all the withdrawals that happened out of funds earlier in the year, that may have forced them to recognize some gains. People still hold those funds are going to get those gains distributed out to them. So you may not have done a lot in your own portfolio, but if you hold mutual funds, you might have some gains coming your way here in the next few weeks.
Let's talk about income levels. We're in a pandemic. We have still high unemployment. Many people may be mm-hmm. experiencing lower levels of taxable income than in the past. Yeah. We also have this pause on required minimum distributions. Any strategies to bear in mind if you do find yourself in what you hope will be sort of a temporarily low tax bracket?
Yeah, it's one of the unfortunate things of this year is we are seeing people who are going to have lower levels of income than what they're used to. But again, take a positive attitude. View that as an opportunity maybe to take advantage of some things and to time certain transactions. If your income is artificially low this year and you expect it to bounce back next year to a more normal level, whether that's through work or RMDs, as you mentioned, maybe this is the year you recognize maybe some additional income from retirement accounts. Consider a Roth conversion. If your income is artificially low and you're in a lower bracket than you might normally be, this might be the year to consider a conversion. Remember, with conversions in particular, there's no recharacterizations anymore. So you've got to really want to do the conversion. You can't undo it. Other things to think about might be if you're a business owner, maybe trying to accelerate a little bit of billings to bring some additional income into this year, pushing off some of the expenses that you might have incurred into next year where they might be more valuable to you. Again, people with lower levels of income, your deductions aren't going to be as valuable to you. So maybe delaying some of those year-end charitable gifts into January, they might provide a little larger tax benefit for you next year than they would this year. So when you're at lower levels of income, the general rule of thumb is accelerate income, defer deductions. And that's going to be kind of the rule of thumb for a lot of folks this year.
You mentioned deductions, you mentioned charitable contributions. Can you shed a little more light on that for people who are thinking about making those year-end charitable gifts? Any tips that you can share on that front?
Yeah. So, you know, obviously with the changes in the tax law a few years ago, a lot fewer people are able to itemize their deductions. It's down to about 10% of taxpayers, or about a third of the people who used to itemize still itemize now. So it's harder to get a tax benefit for those charitable gifts like we used to just kind of take for granted. If you are somebody who can take advantage of that, though, maybe you're looking at like a bunching strategy where you're accelerating prior future year contributions into this year, where you're going to bunch them all and get a deduction this year. Maybe you do that in combination with something like a donor advised fund that allows you to get the tax benefit right away while still maintaining some control over the assets and distributing them out to charities later on. Or maybe if you're not somebody who's itemizing, but you're old enough to qualify, maybe you look at something like a qualified charitable distribution that can be a great way to get some money out of retirement plans and pass on to charity without having to worry about any tax consequences. So otherwise, if you're making charitable gifts, we always recommend considering things like appreciated property rather than cash gifts, because you not only get the same deduction value, but you also avoid the capital gain. So take advantage of some of those more basic charitable giving opportunities that are out there. Make sure the gifts are completed by end of year, though. If you want to get the deduction, you got to have it done before the end of the year.
And the CARES Act also had a provision that allows even non-itemizers to get a little bit of a charitable deduction, right?
Yeah, exactly. So this is part of the CARES Act this year, where they allowed for people who don't itemize their deductions, which, as I said, is like 90% of taxpayers now, to still be able to get a small benefit for charitable gifts. If you give up to $300 in cash to public charities, you can take what they call an above-the-line deduction for that. So you get a tax benefit for it in addition to your standard deduction that you might be claiming. If you itemize, you don't get that, but it is a nice benefit. It is a $300 amount regardless of your filing status. So, you know, if you're a single person, you get $300. Married couples get the same $300. It's a little bit of a marriage penalty there, but we'll take that $300 deduction if we can get it.
Absolutely. Tim, thank you so much for being here. It's always so helpful.
Great. Thanks, Christine.
Thanks for watching. I'm Christine Benz for Morningstar.
6 days a week, we deliver the latest news for investors. Just say, Alexa, enable the Morningstar skill, or visit morningstar.com/Alexa. Now, Christine Benz and Susan Jabinski from Morningstar Inc. break down the new math on emergency funds.
Hi, I'm Susan Jabinski with Morningstar. The pandemic and related job losses are shining a spotlight on the importance of having a liquid reserve as part of your financial plan. But is the standard rule of thumb of 3 to 6 months worth of living expenses sufficient? Joining me today to discuss the topic is Christine Benz. Christine is Morningstar's Director of Personal Finance. Hi, Christine. Thanks for being here today.
Susan, always great to be here. Thank you.
Now, let's first talk a little bit about why are emergency funds so important?
Well, the key reason is that we all have unexpected expenses that crop up. Job loss certainly is another key reason to maintain an emergency fund. And if you have that buffer of cash, the idea is that you won't need to resort to unattractive forms of financing those unexpected costs. So you won't need to put them on credit cards. You won't need to raid your 401k or IRA. So that's really the key reason.
Now, some people might assume that pulling together a sufficient emergency fund might be more challenging for lower income workers. But in fact, this is a challenge that spans all income levels, right?
Well, as you might expect, it is harder for lower income folks to amass emergency reserves. Pew Research put out this survey earlier this year that looked at emergency reserves. So do you have 3 months in liquid reserves? Looked at that question by income band. And as you might expect, about 75% of people with low incomes did not have those emergency reserves. But the surprising thing is, about half of people at middle income levels did not have 3 months worth of liquid reserves, and about a fourth of people at higher income levels. So this problem, this issue, cuts across income levels, though obviously it's a bigger deal and much harder for people at lower income levels.
Now, the CARES Act, which was passed into law earlier this year, allows those who have been impacted by COVID-19 to tap into their 401k plans and their IRAs. What do you think of that idea?
Well, it's a very generous consumer-friendly law overall in that people who do need to tap their 401ks or IRAs because they've either had economic or physical hardship due to COVID-19 can actually get in there, take the money out, and then they can put the money back in. So they have up to 3 years to get the money back into the account so they can make themselves whole on the money that they've taken out. So from that standpoint, it's a decent avenue for people who are in need of short-term funds. But a couple of reasons why it's not a great idea. One is certainly the opportunity cost. If your money's not in there earning, it's going to be lower over time than if you had left the money undisturbed. And then another point I would make is that research points to there being sort of a potato chip factor in play with regard to taking money out of 401ks. So once someone gets in there and takes money for some really legitimate financial need, they'll probably find other reasons to get in there and use the funds for other purposes. So it's like bringing the bag of potato chips in the house. Once you get started, it's hard to stop. And so that's another sort of red flag related to pulling prematurely from 401ks and IRAs.
Now, you know, the standard rule of thumb has we've always heard is 3 to 6 months worth of living expenses for your emergency fund. But are there certain groups of people who should maybe have a little bit more than that set aside?
Absolutely. So contract workers, people with lumpy incomes, people who work on commissions, for example, people with highly volatile, what we call human capital, should be sure to have a higher level of liquid reserves. People with more specialized career paths, higher income workers, those jobs are generally harder to replace if lost, so they should run with a higher buffer as well. I would also add in older workers, Susan, because one thing we saw in the last recession is that older workers took a longer time to replace the jobs that they had lost. So they didn't experience job loss to the extent that younger workers did, but it did take them longer to find jobs if they lost them. So those would be some groups that I would highlight as needing probably closer to a year's worth of liquid reserves if they can possibly swing it.
And what groups of people on the flip side might be able to make do with slightly smaller emergency funds?
Well, a small category would be anyone with sort of a guaranteed income stream. So the tenured college professor, for example, who is not at big risk of job loss, might have a lower emergency fund. Also, I would say younger workers, especially those who are still somewhat flexible in terms of their lifestyles and living arrangements. You know, if they're willing to get roommates or move back with mom and dad, if their lifestyle is somewhat in flux, they can absorb losses, job losses, more than workers who are more established, like the single earner who's responsible for a family of five, for example. So I think that that flexibility would buy younger workers potentially the chance to have a little bit less in liquid reserves.
So given that so many people do struggle with building up that emergency fund, what tips do you have for making it a little less painful for people?
Well, I think one thing to think about is that you don't need to have on hand, say, 3 to 6 months worth of what you're spending today. Remember that if you did experience job loss, you would probably make some cuts in your budget. So think about your very basic expenditures and use that to right size your emergency fund. And I think if you do that, you'll make it a little bit more manageable. Another thing that I like is the idea of kind of automating those emergency fund contributions. So until you get up to the level where you're hoping to be, just have those contributions get deployed directly from your bank account into the investment account, into the cash reserves until you're up to your target level. And then another thing I would note, Susan, is that some employers are adding this emergency fund idea alongside the 401k fund. So you're not able to receive tax breaks, but look for that. UPS, for example, recently added that for its employers. I think it's a terrific consumer-friendly option. So those are just a few ideas.
Yeah, that's great. If you can't see it, you don't touch it as easily, right?
Exactly.
Well, Christine, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Susan.
I'm Susan Jabinski with Morningstar. Thank you for tuning in.
Watch all the Morningstar content you love from your living room. Download the Morningstar Roku channel and get up-to-date independent insights on today's markets. Be comfortable. Be informed.
Next, Russ Kinnell from Morningstar Research Services covers the remarkable returns and positives from 2020's market rotation.
Hi, I'm Susan Jabinski with Morningstar. Large cap growth stocks have enjoyed remarkable returns this year. But in November, we saw some sector market rotation where smaller companies and value stocks gained a little bit of ground. Here with me today to go through all the numbers is Russ Kinnell. Russ is Morningstar's Director of Manager Research, as well as the editor of Morningstar Fund Investor. Hi, Russ. Nice to see you. Thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
So let's talk a little bit first about just how dominant large cap growth strategies have been. You know, they came into 2020 with a nice tailwind from 2019. And it seems like for a large part of 2020, they spent their time increasing the gap in performance between value and smaller cap names. Can you talk a little bit about why that was?
You're right. So going in, we've been long talking about the FANGs, the Facebook, Amazon, Google kind of names that have been dominating performance. And that was even before this year. So if anything, you'd have expected to reverse, but no, growth just crushed value even more. And to a degree, COVID even accelerated that. And the reason is that a lot of the value side is economically sensitive. So if you think about oil and any kind of energy companies, airlines, a lot of the value side is economically sensitive. Of course, out of the blue, sort in a sense, COVID came in and crushed the economy. So very harsh on value. Then on the other hand, some of the solutions to our new problems of trying to stay at home lived over in growth land. So things like Zoom and Amazon and others were profiting tremendously from that. So we had a growth dominant market that then became an even much bigger gap between growth and value.
But the pattern shifted a little bit in November, right, Russ, after the election and after we got some good news on the vaccine front.
That's right. The market started to rally on the election news, and then we got the vaccine news the week after the election, and now we've had a second vaccine announced with really great results. And so it's really dramatically led to reversal in the markets. And the reason is that, again, now we can see light at the end of the tunnel. A lot of economically sensitive names now can say, okay, the economy may well spring back very strongly in, let's say, March or April. That's just a guess. But somewhere out there, these vaccines imply that the economy will be able to get back to normal. So airlines and energy and a lot of the other industries are doing great. So just for the month to date through November 17th, we have small value up over 17%, and large growth is the worst of our style box categories, up a little under 9%. So a really dramatic reversal in fortune.
And are there any particular funds that you'd like to comment on that did particularly well during this stretch?
Yeah, so if you own a value fund that you've really been hating and has been disastrous, it probably looks good. So two of the best performers month to date are Causeway Global Value, Causeway International Value, but also funds like Oakmark International and Oakmark Global or Hotchkiss and Wiley Midcap Value. These are companies that these are funds are all kind of deep value, and all of them have a significant energy and other economic exposure. And so those funds that I all mentioned, those are all up 20% or better. So just for the month today, so really a dramatic rally from some of the funds that have done worse. And I should also mention that even at almost all those funds are still in the red for year to date. So it's been a great rally, but you're still probably not feeling real rich if you own those funds.
Let's pivot over to the fixed income side. Let's talk about bonds in November. What did they do during this rally we've seen in value and small caps?
Yeah, the first bit of news on the vaccine led to the long end of the market selling off a bit because, of course, the long end is very economically sensitive. But then since then, we actually saw that's kind of reversed a bit, and now it's the short end that's hurting a little. But really, these are only like very minuscule losses. So the bond market hasn't been great, but you didn't lose money for the most part. Now it's mostly flat. So it is kind of a reversal, of course, of what we saw, say, in March when bonds rallied sharply on the expectation that the economy would really slow down.
So, you know, at the end of the day, Russ, if investors are looking at their results for 2020, what is the story? How do things look for them?
Well, even after this huge reversal, growth is still in great shape. The typical large growth fund up 28%, typical small value fund down 4%. So we've had a great lesson this last month in how quickly that can turn. You can't really predict those sort of things, but it really changed quickly. So for sure, growth is still very expensive, and value by most measures is still pretty cheap. But I do think it does illustrate just how hard it is to predict, especially in the short run. Who would have predicted such a big change in fortune in just a couple of weeks?
Well, Russ, thank you so much for your time and for helping us put these numbers in perspective. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
I'm Susan Jabinski for Morningstar. Thank you for tuning in.
Now, David Swartz from Morningstar Research Services shares two bargains in the retail industry.
Like the rest of the year, the 2020 holiday shopping season promises to be filled with uncertainty and anxiety. The COVID-19 pandemic has caused an economic shock and disrupted normal shopping patterns throughout the year as physical stores have been forced to close or limit visitation while online shopping has skyrocketed. Now, the rising number of virus cases in the United States, Europe, and elsewhere threatens to bring new restrictions and further stress to the economy. In response, retailers and consumer products companies have prepared for a longer selling season in which e-commerce is the top priority and discounts are the norm. We have seen a huge divergence this year in the performance of retail stocks, as some have been crushed while others have soared to new all-time highs. One retail stock that's not yet fully recovered from the downturn is Nomo Kohl's, which has dropped from about $50 at the beginning of this year to about $27 today. We rate Kohl's at 4 stars as it trades at a roughly 30% discount to our fair value estimate of $38.50 per share. Kohl's has faced big challenges from the pandemic, but it produced about $4.5 billion in e-commerce last year and should benefit from problems of rivals like JCPenney. While Kohl's reported a loss this year, it was consistently profitable before the pandemic, and we expect profits going forward. We forecast Kohl's will earn over $3 per share in 2022. Another stock to consider this holiday season is Narrowmoat Mattel, the producer of popular toys like Barbie and Hot Wheels. At about $14, Mattel trades at a 30% discount to our fair value estimate of $20 per share and is rated 4 stars. In response to industry turmoil and poor results, Mattel has reshaped its operations to improve its profit margins and eliminated about $875 million in annual expenses. By the middle of this decade, we forecast it will achieve annual operating margins above 14%, from less than 10% today, and sustainable gross margins above 50%. We forecast Mattel will earn more than $1 per share in 2023.
Lastly, Holly Black from Morningstar UK interviews Michael Jansi of Sustainalytics, a Morningstar company.
Welcome to the Morningstar Digital Investment Conference. I'm Holly Black. With me is Michael Jansi. He's the founder of Sustainalytics. Hello.
Hello. How are you?
I'm good. Good to have you here. And we're talking ESG and sustainable investing. This is a huge topic. It feels like it's really picking up traction in the investment world. Why do you think we're at an inflection point for ESG?
Well, I think it's a number of different reasons. And maybe the first can sum up in just one word, and that's growth. We're seeing tremendous growth in the interest in sustainable investing. I mean, the growth has largely been driven over the last decade or so by institutional investors, so large asset owners and the investment managers that serve them. And that's really global. There's really not a developed market in the world where this isn't gaining traction. And it's really driven by the institutional investors saying, you know, environmental social issues are not just about values. These are real risks and opportunities that need to be looked at alongside the traditional financial analysis that we've always done in the investment side to really position us for good outcomes on behalf of our client. We're talking about a sustainable finance ecosystem because companies are also embracing sustainability in a very meaningful way and integrating sustainability metrics into their strategic planning and business planning and raising capital through sustainable investment tools and so on. So, you know, we're at an inflection point in part because you have investors and companies looking at sustainability in a new way.
But there are a lot of people still are cautious about ESG investing. What do you think some of the biggest challenges for this space are?
Well, I do think there has historically been caution around this space because people believe that, you know, if you're mixing an examination of environmental and social issues into a financial decision making, for some reason that's going to hamper or lead to a negative impact on returns. That's been flipped on its head now because I said the growth in this space has really been about integrating environmental social issues into a process to make smarter decisions, again, to position you better down the road. But, you know, we need to do a better job in corporate disclosure on environmental and social issues. And we need to bring some formality and structure to that in the same way that we have a certain level of expectations on financial reporting. And that has been a challenge. There's been too many different frameworks out there. And it's been voluntary. And I'm encouraged now because that challenge seems to be moving in the right direction. We're now seeing accounting bodies like IFRS and others that are stepping into the fray and starting to say, well, maybe we have a role here to bring some structure, formality to ESG disclosure at the corporate level And so we're now looking at, you know, what different stakeholders think the roles of these accounting bodies and other formal bodies should be. So I'm quite encouraged by that.
And I feel that as investors try and navigate this space, and it is changing constantly, this is where the financial advisor comes in. Do you think this is a big opportunity for IFAs?
I think it's a tremendous opportunity, because what the research shows is that clients are embracing sustainable investing in ways that they haven't before. And they're looking at sustainable investing from a number of different perspectives. One of my favorite studies in this space was done by Schroders. They do it every year. It's a global survey. And I mean, it's just one example that highlights the fact that whether investors are looking for a sustainable investing alternative because they believe it informs an investment decision and, again, will help them achieve those financial outcomes or better position them for those good financial outcomes over time, whether they want to have a positive environmental or social impact with their investing, or if they simply want to align their investing with their own values, there are a number of very powerful drivers now that are leading individuals to want to invest in this way. And we're starting to see significant fund flows in Europe, in the United States, and other markets around the world that reflect this trend. And the good news for investors is, well, their clients are looking to them to help them solve their investment goals and help them reach their objectives. And part of those objectives now are around sustainable investing. So it's a wonderful opportunity for advisors to step up to the plate and do that.
Michael, thank you so much for your time. For Morningstar, I'm Holly Black.
That does it for this week's Investing Insights podcast from Morningstar. We hope you have enjoyed our program and we welcome your feedback. Please send your comments and questions to podcast@morningstar.com. From everyone here at Morningstar, thanks for listening. This recording is for informational purposes only and should not be considered investment advice. Opinions expressed are as of the date of recording. Such opinions are subject to change. The views and opinions of guests on this program are not necessarily those of Morningstar Inc. and its affiliates. Morningstar and its affiliates are not affiliated with this guest or his or her business affiliates unless otherwise stated. Morningstar does not guarantee the accuracy or the completeness of the data presented herein. The podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be considered tax advice. Please consult a tax and/or financial professional for advice specific to your individual circumstances. Morningstar Research Services, LLC is a subsidiary of Morningstar Inc. and is registered with and governed by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Morningstar Research Services shall not be responsible for any trading decisions, damages, or other losses resulting from or related to the information, data analysis, or opinions or their use. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results. All investments are subject to investment risk, including possible loss of principal. Individuals should seriously consider if an investment is suitable for them by referencing their own financial position, investment objectives, and risk profile before making any investment decision.